There was a village in a lower valley a few miles from the temple, which acted as a sort of service industry. From the air, it was a random scattering of small but extremely well soundproofed huts. "Anywhere will do," the abbot said. Mort left him standing a few feet above the snow at a point where the huts appeared to be thickest. "Hope the next lifetime improves," he said. The abbot shrugged. "One can always hope," he said. "I get a 9-month break anyway. The scenery isn't much, but at least it's in the warm." "Bye then," said Mort. "I've got a rush." "Au revoir," said the abbot sadly and turned away. The fires of the hub lights were still casting their flickering illumination across the landscape. Mort sighed and reached for the third glass. The container was silver, decorated with small crowns. There was hardly any sand left. Mort, feeling that the knight had thrown everything at him and couldn't get any worse, turned it around carefully to get a glimpse of the name. Princess Kay Lee awoke. There had been a sound like someone making no noise at all. Forget peas and mattresses. Sheer natural selection had established over the years that the royal families that survived longest were those whose members could distinguish an assassin in the dark by the noise he was clever enough not to make, because in court circles there was always someone ready to cut the air with a knife. She lay in bed, wondering what to do next. There was a dagger under her pillow. She started to slide one hand up the sheets while peering around the room with half-closed eyes in search of unfamiliar shadows. She was well aware that if she indicated in any way that she was not asleep, she would never wake up again. Some light came into the room from the big window at the far end, but the suits of armour, tapestries and assorted paraphernalia that littered the room could have provided cover for an army. The knife had dropped down behind the bedhead. She probably wouldn't have used it properly anyway. Screaming for the guards, she decided, was not a good idea. If there was anyone in the room, then the guards must have been overpowered, or at least stunned by a large sum of money. There was a warming pan on the flagstones by the fire. Would it make a weapon? There was a faint metallic sound. Perhaps screaming wouldn't be such a bad idea after all. The window imploded. For an instant, Kay Lee saw, framed against a hell of blue and purple flames, a hooded figure crouched on the back of the largest horse she had ever seen. There was someone standing by the bed, with a knife half raised. In slow motion, she watched, fascinated, as the arm went up and the horse galloped at glacier speed across the floor. Now the knife was above her, starting its descent, and the horse was rearing, and the rider was standing in the stirrups and swinging some sort of weapon, and its blade tore through the slow air with a noise like a finger on the rim of a wet glass. The light vanished. There was a soft thump on the floor, followed by a metallic clatter. Kay Lee took a deep breath. A hand was briefly laid across her mouth, and a worried voice said, "If you scream, I'll regret it. Please, I'm in enough trouble as it is." Anyone who could get that amount of bewildered pleading into their voice was either genuine or such a good actor they wouldn't have to bother with assassination for a living. She said, "Who are you?" "I don't know if I'm allowed to tell you," said the voice. "You are still alive, aren't you?" She bit down the sarcastic reply just in time. Something about the tone of the question worried her. "Can't you tell?" she said. "It's not easy." There was a pause. She strained to see in the darkness to put a face around that voice. "I may have done you some terrible harm," it added. "Haven't you just saved my life?" "I don't know what I have saved, actually. Is there some light around here?" "The maid sometimes leaves matches on the mantelpiece," said Kay Lee. She felt the presence beside her move away. There were a few hesitant footsteps, a couple of thumps, and finally a clang, although the word isn't sufficient to describe the real ripe cacophony of falling metal that filled the room. It was even followed by the traditional little tinkle a couple of seconds after you thought it was all over. The voice said, rather indistinctly, "I'm under a suit of armour. Where should I be?" Kay Lee slid quietly out of the bed, felt her way towards the fireplace, located the bundle of matches by the faint light from the dying fire, struck one in a burst of sulphurous smoke, lit a candle, found the pile of dismembered armour, pulled its sword from its scabbard, and then nearly swallowed her tongue. Someone had just blown hot and wetly in her ear. "That's Binky," said the heap. "He's just trying to be friendly. I expect he'd like some hay, if you've got any." With royal self-control, Kay Lee said, "This is the fourth floor. It's a lady's bedroom. You'd be amazed how many horses we don't get up here." Oh, could you help me up, please? She put the sword down and pulled aside a breastplate. A thin white face stared back at her. First, you'd better tell me why I shouldn't send for the guards anyway, she said. Even being in my bedroom, you could get tortured to death. She glared at him. Finally, he said, Well, could you let my hand free, please? Thank you. Firstly, the guards probably wouldn't see me. Second, you'll never find out why I'm here, and you look as though you'd hate not to know. And thirdly...
Thirdly what? She said.
His mouth opened and shut. Mort wanted to say, Thirdly, you're so beautiful, or at least very attractive, or anyway, far more attractive than any other girl I've ever met, although, admittedly, I haven't met very many. From this it will be seen that Mort's innate honesty will never make him a poet. If Mort ever compared a girl to a summer's day, it would be followed by a thoughtful explanation of what day he had in mind and whether it was raining at the time. In the circumstances, it was just as well that he couldn't find his voice. Kaylee held up the candle and looked at the window. It was whole. The stone frames were unbroken. Every pane, with its stained glass representatives of the Stolart coat of arms, was complete. She looked back at Mort.
Never mind thirdly, she said. Let's get back to secondly.
An hour later, dawn reached the city. Daylight on the disk flows rather than rushes, because light is slowed right down by the world's standing magical field. And it rolled across the flat lands like a golden sea. The city on the mound stood out like a sandcastle in the tide for a moment, until the day swirled around it and crept onwards. Mort and Kaylee sat side by side on her bed. The hourglass lay between them. There was no sand left in the top bulb. From outside came the sounds of the castle waking up.
"I still don't understand this," she said. "Does it mean I'm dead or doesn't it?"
"It means you ought to be dead," he said. "According to fate or whatever, I haven't really studied the theory."
"And you should have killed me?"
"No. I mean, no, the assassin should have killed you." "I did try to explain all that," said Mort.
"Why didn't you let him?"
Mort looked at her in horror.
"Did you want to die?" "Of course I didn't. But it looks as though what people want doesn't come into it, does it? I'm trying to be sensible about this."
Mort stared at his knees, then he stood up.
"I think I'd better be going," he said coldly.
He folded up the scythe and stuck it into its sheath behind the saddle. Then he looked at the window.
"You came through that," said Kaylee helpfully. "Look, when I said,
does it open?"
"No. There's a balcony along the passage, but people will see you."
Mort ignored her, pulled open the door, and led Binky out into the corridor. Kaylee ran after them. A maid stopped, curtsied, and frowned slightly as her brain wisely dismissed the sight of a very large horse walking along the carpet. The balcony overlooked one of the inner courtyards. Mort glanced over the parapet and then mounted.
"Watch out for the Duke," he said. "He's behind all this."
"My father always warned me about him," said the princess. "I've got a food taster."
"You should get a bodyguard as well," said Mort. "I must go. I have important things to do. Farewell,"
he added, in what he hoped was the right tone of injured pride.
"Shall I see you again?" said Kelly. "There's lots I want to..."
"That might not be a good idea if you think about it," said Mort haughtily.
He clicked his tongue, and Binky leapt into the air, cleared the parapet, and cantered up into the blue morning sky.
"I wanted to say thank you,"
Kelly yelled after him. The maid, who couldn't get over the feeling that something was wrong and had followed her, said...
"Are you all right, ma'am?"
Kaylee looked at her distractedly.
"What?"
she demanded.
"I just wondered if everything was all right."
Kaylee's shoulders sagged.
"No," she said. "Everything's all wrong. There's a dead assassin in my bedroom. Could you please have something done about it?"
"And," she held up a hand, "I don't want you to say, dead, ma'am, or assassin, ma'am, or scream or anything. I just want you to get something done about it, quietly. I think I've got a headache. So just nod." The maid nodded, bobbed uncertainly, and backed away. Mort wasn't sure how he got back. The sky simply changed from ice blue to sullen grey as Binky eased himself into the gap between dimensions. He didn't land on the dark soil of Death's estate. It was simply there, underfoot, as though an aircraft carrier had gently manoeuvred itself under a jump jet to save the pilot all the trouble of touching down. The great horse trotted into the stable yard and halted outside the double door, swishing his tail. Mort slid off,
and ran for the house, and stopped and ran back, and filled the hay rack, and ran for the house, and stopped and muttered to himself, and ran back, and rubbed the horse down, and checked the water bucket, and ran for the house, and ran back, and fetched the horse blanket down from its hook on the wall, and buckled it on. Binky gave him a dignified nuzzle. No one seemed to be about as Mort slipped in by the back door and made his way to the library, where even at this time of night the air seemed to be made of hot, dry dust. It seemed to take years to locate Princess Kay Lee's biography, but he found it eventually. It was a depressingly slim volume, on a shelf only reachable by the library ladder, a wheeled rickety structure that strongly resembled an early siege engine. With trembling fingers he opened it at the last page and groaned. "The princess's assassination at the age of 15," he read, "was followed by the union of Stolat with Stohelit, and indirectly the collapse of the city-states of the central plain and the rise of..." He read on, unable to stop. Occasionally he groaned again. Finally he put the book back, hesitated, and then shoved it behind a few other volumes. He could still feel it there as he climbed down the ladder, shrieking its incriminating existence to the world. There were few ocean-going ships on the disc. No captain liked to venture out of sight of a coastline. It was a sorry fact that ships which looked from a distance as though they were going over the edge of the world weren't in fact disappearing over the horizon, they were in fact dropping over the edge of the world. Every generation or so, a few enthusiastic explorers doubted this and set out to prove it wrong. Strangely enough, none of them had ever come back to announce the result of their researches. The following analogy would therefore have been meaningless to Mort. He felt as if he'd been shipwrecked on the Titanic, but in the nick of time had been rescued by the Lusitania. He felt as though he'd thrown a snowball on the spur of the moment and watched the ensuing avalanche engulf three ski resorts. He felt history unravelling all around him. He felt he needed someone to talk to quickly. That had to mean either Albert or Isabel, because the thought of explaining everything to those tiny blue pinpoints was not one he cared to contemplate after a long night. On the rare occasions Isabel deigned to look in his direction, she made it clear that the only difference between Mort and a dead toad was the colour. As for Albert, all right, not the perfect confidant, but definitely the best in a field of one. Mort slid down the steps and threaded his way back through the bookshelves. A few hours' sleep would be a good idea, too. Then he heard a gasp, the brief patter of running feet, and the slam of a door. When he peered around the nearest bookcase, there was nothing there except a stool with a couple of books on it. He picked one up and glanced at the name, then read a few pages. There was a damp lace handkerchief lying next to it. Mort rose late and hurried towards the kitchen, expecting at any moment the deep tones of disapproval. Nothing happened. Albert was at the stone sink, gazing thoughtfully at his chip pan, probably wondering whether it was time to change the fat or let it bide for another year. He turned as Mort slid into a chair. "You had a busy time of it, then," he said. "Gallivanting all over the place until all hours, I heard. I could do you an egg, or there's porridge." "Egg, please," said Mort. He'd never plucked up the courage to try Albert's porridge, which led a private life of its own in the depths of its saucepan, and ate spoons. "The master wants to see you after," Albert added. "But he said you wasn't to rush." "Oh," Mort stared at the table. "Did he say anything else?" "He said he hadn't had an evening off in 1,000 years, said Albert. He was humming. "I don't like it. I've never seen him like this." "Oh," Mort took the plunge.
"Albert, have you been here long?"
Albert looked at him over the top of his spectacles.
"Maybe," he said. "It's hard to keep track of outside time, boy. I've been here since just after the old king died."
"Which king, Albert?"
"Arthur Rollo, I think he was called. Little fat man, squeaky voice. I only saw him the once, though."
"Where was this?"
"In Ankh, of course."
"What?" said Mort. "They don't have kings in Ankh-Morpork. Everyone knows that."
This was back a bit, I said, said Albert.
He poured himself a cup of tea from Death's personal teapot and sat down, a dreamy look in his crusted eyes. Mort waited expectantly.
"And they was kings in those days, real kings. Not like the sort you get now. They was monarchs,
continued Albert, carefully pouring some tea into his saucer and fanning it primly with the end of his muffler.
"I mean, they was wise and fair.
Well, fairly wise.
And they wouldn't think twice about cutting your head off soon as look at you," he added approvingly. "And all the queens were tall and pale and wore them balaclava helmet things."
"Wimples?" said Mort.
"Yeah, them. And the princesses were beautiful as the day is long, and so noble they could pee through a dozen mattresses."
"What?" Albert hesitated.
"Something like that, anyway," he conceded. "And there was balls and tournaments and executions. Great days."
He smiled dreamily at his memories.
"Not like the sort of days you get now," he said, emerging from his reverie with bad grace.
"Have you got any other names, Albert?" said Mort. But the brief spell had been broken, and the old man wasn't going to be drawn.
"Oh, I know," he snapped. "Get Albert's name and you'll go and look him up in the library, won't you? Prying and poking. I know you. Skulking in there at all hours, reading the lives of young women."
The heralds of guilt must have flourished their tarnished trumpets in the depths of Mort's eyes, because Albert cackled and prodded him with a bony finger.
"You might at least put them back where you find them," he said, "not leave piles of them around for old Albert to put back. Anyway, it's not right, ogling the poor dead things. Probably turns you blind."
"But I only—" Mort began, and remembered the damp lace handkerchief in his pocket and shut up. He left Albert grumbling to himself and doing the washing up, and slipped into the library. Pale sunlight lanced down from the high windows, gently fading the covers on the patient ancient volumes. Occasionally a speck of dust would catch the light as it floated through the golden shafts and flare like a miniature supernova. Mort knew that if he listened hard enough, he could hear the insect-like scritching of the books as they wrote themselves. Once upon a time, Mort would have found it eerie. Now it was reassuring. It demonstrated that the universe was running smoothly. His conscience, which had been looking for the opening, gleefully reminded him that, all right, it might be running smoothly, but it certainly wasn't heading in the right direction. He made his way through the maze of shelves to the mysterious pile of books and found it was gone. Albert had been in the kitchen, and Mort had never seen Death himself enter the library. What was Isabel looking for, then? He glanced up at the cliff of shelves above him, and his stomach went cold when he thought of what was starting to happen. There was nothing for it. He'd have to tell someone. Kelly, meanwhile, was also finding life difficult. This was because causality had an incredible amount of inertia. Mort's misplaced thrust, driven by anger and desperation and nascent love, had sent it down a new track, but it hadn't noticed yet. He'd kicked the tail of the dinosaur, but it would be some time before the other end realized it was time to say ouch. Bluntly, the universe knew Kaylee was dead, and was therefore rather surprised to find that she hadn't stopped walking and breathing yet. It showed in little ways. The courtiers who gave her furtive-odd looks during the morning would not have been able to say why the sight of her made them feel strangely uncomfortable. To their acute embarrassment and her annoyance, they found themselves ignoring her, or talking in hushed voices. The Chamberlain found he'd instructed that the royal standard be flown at half-mast, and for the life of him couldn't explain why. He was gently led off to his bed with a mild nervous affliction, after ordering 1,000 yards of black bunting for no apparent reason. The eerie, unreal feeling soon spread throughout the castle. The head coachman ordered the state beer to be brought out again and polished, and then stood in the stable-yard and wept into his chamois leather because he couldn't remember why. Servants walked softly along the corridors. The cook had to fight an overpowering urge to prepare simple banquets of cold meat. Dogs howled and then stopped, feeling rather stupid. The 2 black stallions who traditionally pulled the Stowlat funeral cortege grew restive in their stalls and nearly kicked a groom to death. In his castle in Stow Helit, the Duke waited in vain for a messenger who had in fact set out, but had stopped halfway down the street, unable to remember what it was he was supposed to be doing. Through all this, Kaylee moved like a solid and increasingly more irritated ghost. Things came to a head at lunchtime. She swept into the great hall and found no place had been set in front of the royal chair. By speaking loudly and distinctly to the butler, she managed to get that rectified, then saw dishes being passed in front of her before she could get a fork into them. She watched in sullen disbelief as the wine was brought in and poured first for the Lord of the Privy Closet. It was an unregal thing to do, but she stuck out a foot and tripped the wine waiter. He stumbled, muttered something under his breath, and stared down at the flagstones. She leaned the other way and shouted into the ear of the yeoman of the pantry. "Can you see me, man? Why are we reduced to eating cold pork and ham?" He turned aside from his hushed conversation with the lady of the small hexagonal room in the north turret, gave her a long look in which shock made way for a sort of unfocused puzzlement, and said, "Your Royal Highness," prompted Cayley. "Highness," he muttered. There was a heavy pause. Then, as if switched back on, he turned his back on her and resumed his conversation. Cayley sat for a while, white with shock and anger, then pushed the chair back and stormed away to her chambers. A couple of servants, sharing a quick roll-up in the passage outside, were knocked sideways by something they couldn't quite see. Cayley ran into her room and hauled on the rope that should have sent the duty maid running in from the sitting room at the end of the corridor. Nothing happened for some time, and then the door was pushed open slowly, and a face peered in at her. She recognised the look this time, and was ready for it. She grabbed the maid by the shoulders and hauled her bodily into the room, slamming the door shut behind her. As the frightened woman stared everywhere but at Cayley, she hauled off and fetched her a stinging slap across the cheek. "Did you feel that? Did you feel it?" she shrieked. The maid whimpered, staggering backwards until she hit the bed and sitting down heavily on it. "Look at me! Look at me when I talk to you!" yelled Cayley, advancing on her. "You can see me, can't you? Tell me you can see me, or I'll have you executed!" The maid stared into her terrified eyes.
"I can see you," she said, "but—"
"But what? But what?"
"Surely, I heard, I thought—"
"What did you think?" snapped Cayley. She wasn't shouting anymore. Her words came out like white-hot whips. The maid collapsed into a sobbing heap. Cayley stood tapping her foot for a moment, and then shook the woman gently. "Is there a wizard in the city?" she said. "Look at me. At me. There's a wizard, isn't there? You girls are always skulking off to talk to wizards. Where does he live?" The woman turned a tear-stained face towards her, fighting against every instinct that told her the princess didn't exist.
Wizard, yes. Cutwell, in Wall Street."
Cayley's lips compressed into a thin smile. She wondered where her cloaks were kept, but cold reason told her it was going to be a damn sight easier to find them herself than try to make her presence felt to the maid. She waited, watching closely, as the woman stopped sobbing, looked around her in vague bewilderment, and hurried out of the room. "She's forgotten me already," she thought. She looked at her hands. She seemed solid enough. It had to be magic. She wandered into her robing room and experimentally opened a few cupboards until she found a black cloak and a hood. She slipped them on and darted out into the corridor and down the servants' stairs. She hadn't been this way since she was little. This was the world of linen cupboards, bare floors, and dumb waiters. It smelled of slightly stale crusts. Cayley moved through it like an earthbound spook. She was aware of the servants' quarters, of course, in the same way that people are aware at some level in their minds of the drains or the guttering, and she would be quite prepared to concede that although servants all looked pretty much alike, they must have some distinguishing features by which their nearest and dearest could presumably identify them. But she was not prepared for sights like Moghedron, the wine butler, whom she had hitherto seen only as a stately presence moving like a galleon under full sail, sitting in his pantry with his jacket undone and smoking a pipe. A couple of maids ran past her without a second glance, giggling. She hurried on, aware that in some strange way she was trespassing in her own castle. And that, she realised, was because it wasn't her castle at all. The noisy world around her, with its steaming laundries and chilly stillrooms, was its own world. She couldn't own it. Possibly it owned her. She took a chicken leg from the table in the biggest kitchen, a cavern lined with so many pots that by the light of its fires it looked like an armoury for tortoises, and felt the unfamiliar thrill of theft. Theft in her own kingdom. And the cook looked straight through her, eyes as glazed as jugged ham. Cayley ran across the stable yards and out of the back gate, past a couple of sentries whose stern gaze quite failed to notice her. Out in the streets it wasn't so creepy, but she still felt oddly naked. It was unnerving being among people who were going about their own affairs and not bothering to look at one when one's entire experience of the world hitherto
was that it revolved around one. Pedestrians bumped into one and rebounded away, wondering briefly what it was they'd hit, and one several times had to scurry out of the way of the path of wagons. The chicken leg hadn't gone far to fill the hole left by the absence of lunch, and she filched a couple of apples from a stall, making a mental note to have the Chamberlain find out how much apples cost and send some money down to the stallholder. Dishevelled, rather grubby, and smelling slightly of horse dung, she came at last to Cutwell's door. The knocker gave her some trouble. In her experience, doors opened for you. There were special people to arrange it. She was so distraught she didn't even notice that the knocker winked at her. She tried again, and thought she heard a distant crash. After some time, the door opened a few inches, and she caught a glimpse of a round, flustered face, topped with curly hair. Her right foot surprised her by intelligently inserting itself in the crack. "I demand to see the wizard," she announced. "Pray admit me this instant."
"He's rather busy at present," said the face. "Were you after a love potion?"
"A what?"
"We've got a special on Cutwell's Shield of Passion ointment," said the face, and winked in a startling fashion. "Provides your wild oats while guaranteeing a crop failure, if you know what I mean."
Kelly bridled. "No," she lied coldly, "I do not."
"Ram rub, maiden's long stop, belladonna eye drops."
"I demand—"
"Sorry, we're closed," said the face, and shut the door.
Kelly withdrew her foot just in time. She muttered some words that would have amazed and shocked her tutors, and thumped on the woodwork. The tattoo of her hammering suddenly slowed as realization dawned. He'd seen her. He'd heard her. She beat on the door with renewed vigor, yelling with all the power in her lungs. A voice by her ear said,
"It won't work. He is very stubborn."
She looked around slowly and met the impertinent gaze of the door knocker. It waggled its metal eyebrows at her and spoke indistinctly through its wrought iron ring. "I am Princess Kaylee, heir to the throne of Stolat," she said haughtily, holding down the lid on her terror, "and I don't talk to door furniture."
"Well, I'm just a door knocker, and I can talk to whoever I please,"
said the gargoyle pleasantly,
"and I can tell you the master is having a trying day and doth not want to be disturbed. But you could try to use the magic word,"
it added.
"Coming from a detractive woman, it works 9 times out of 8.